WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
There's much too little cooperation across party lines and much too much separation and shouting at each other.
Senator Lieberman again from our interview last hour, and with that it's 30 issues in 30 days, issue 29. Do American politics need to be so polarized? Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we are almost at the end of our 2006 election series, 30 issues in 30 days. We began 28 programs ago by asking if we need a war on terror, or if we should call it that. We will end tomorrow by asking if the American middle class is an endangered species, and if so, which party would be better at rescuing it from the brink. But right now, do American politics need to be so polarized? Issue 29. Increasingly, we say we live in red or blue states. If we're conservative, we sneer at anyone called a liberal, and vice versa. There may be as many anti-conservatives and anti-liberals as there are people who are for anything in America today. Are we divided? Are we that divided? Here is former Republican Senator John Danforth of Missouri on this program this summer.
The nature of American politics today is to appeal to the base of both parties at the expense of the center. It used to be that the nature of politics was that each party had roughly a third of the votes, and the rest of the people were up for grabs, and both parties were competing for them. Now the nature of politics is to ignore the center and energize the base. The base of the Republican Party is the Christian conservative. So my party has become a Christian conservative party. And when politics becomes that closely linked with religion, it becomes divisive, and that's what I'm concerned about.
Senator Danforth, any veteran of Washington politics will tell you it is nastier and less collegial in Congress than it used to be, and everyone denounces polarization, but we still have our intense opinions and passionate feelings. So why is this happening? Is it all bad? Who'll break through the polarization? And is that what we want? With me now are two guests, NPR senior political analyst Juan Williams and Harvard public policy professor Robert Putnam from the Kennedy School of Government, author of the books Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and Better Together, Restoring the American Community. He's working on a new book about changing roles of religion in America and just completed a large new survey of American citizens, which I think he will tell us included sharp evidence of polarization. So Juan Williams, Bob Putnam, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much, Brian. It's good to be with you again.
Nice to be here, Brian.
Juan, do you agree with Senator Danforth? Has politics become more about getting out your true believers than trying to convince other people that your ideas are right?
Oh, absolutely. I think you saw that in 2004. In that presidential race, if you'll recall, Brian, going back to Ohio, the key there, and it's still regarded as genius as we approach the midterms this year, is that Karl Rove and the Republicans, Ken Mellman, were able to go into Ohio and not so much convince anybody new to come and vote for the president, so much as to go and find people who were part of the base who previously had not been participating. So that meant going in not only to the suburbs, but to the exurbs, and, you know, micro-targeting people in order to drag them to the polls and say, you know, you have exactly the characteristics that fit our base. Why aren't you bothering to vote? And don't you understand the stakes? So it was a matter of energizing that base. One other quick point is that, you know, picking up on what you heard from Senator Danforth, Senator Lieberman, you know, this goes back now so many years. It's almost becoming an institutionalized part of our political thinking, because I think I would identify much of it as starting with the impeachment of President Clinton. I think that really polarized both sides, and the tactics used there were sufficient to make people sort of dig in and feel that they were personally aggrieved and that the other side was were devils.
Wasn't it going on before that? I mean, even at the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was incredible polarization between the two parties. He was portrayed as the devil, and his wife was too, in various ways. Just days after his election in 1992, he was booed by some of the troops at a Veterans Day speech, I recall, and you know, and people used that. So it was going on for a long time.
Well, I think that we're talking about sort of a matter of magnitude. You know, I think some people didn't like Clinton, but obviously he got elected, and he used what, you know, famously Dick Morris called that triangulation theory to try mm-hmm. to appeal to the American center. You go back and you look at things like welfare reform in 96 and the like, it's all about moving to the center. So he was appealing to the center. What we've seen under the second Bush administration is, and Karl Rove, is a total attention to the base and to the hardest part, the hardcore of the base, which I think, especially after 9/11, was disappointing to some people that you didn't see more of this sort of communal attitude. But it certainly was, to my mind, more extreme than anything we'd seen before.
Okay. Bob Putnam, I understand you've just completed a large new survey of American citizens. What did you find there with respect to polarization?
Well, Brian, one of the things that we asked was to ask people whether they felt America was basically united or basically divided in various ways. And we asked, do you think America is deeply divided along, you know, political lines, along economic lines, along racial lines, along religious lines? And to us, at least, the results were pretty astounding. 67%, two-thirds of Americans think that, just said that they thought America was deeply divided in today in religious terms, 67% in religion. Race, 93% of Americans said they thought America was deeply divided along racial lines. In economics, 96% of Americans said they thought, and similarly, 96% thought that America was deeply divided on political lines. You can't get 96% of Americans to agree that the sky is blue.
Right.
It's stunning how much we feel we're divided. Now, it's a different question, which I know we're going to be talking about now. How do we have that impression? Because it's an interesting puzzle, actually. The explanations are not so simple as you might think. I mean, I think some of the things that that Juan and Senator Danforth and Senator Lieberman talked about are relevant. But what you might think is we're more polarized because we disagree more with one another on issues like abortion or tax policy or foreign policy or, you know, poverty or whatever. But all the research that's been done says Americans now and always have basically been in the muddled middle on those issues. We're not one taken one by one. We don't have more extreme views now than we used to on any of those issues. Most Americans are kind of in the muddled middle. They're neither cut and run nor stay the course on Iraq. Most Americans are kind of in the middle, sort of, on abortion. It's not that we're issue by issue more deeply divided than we used to be. So it's a kind of interesting puzzle. How did we get ourselves in this pickle?
So let me follow up on what you just said and the survey results you were just citing, because it sounds like you asked people to judge the country as a whole, whether we're divided along those lines.
Right.
That's different than asking them if they feel that way themselves.
Absolutely it is. And one reason why, I mean, Americans looking out at the country have the same impression that all of us that we've been talking on the program feel. I mean, it does feel awfully divided. It's actually even, we're aware of that even more sharply because 9/11, one of the things that happened in the aftermath of 9/11 was almost instantly all over America, there was a much greater sense of solidarity and a sense that we're all in this together. I mean, we know that from our polls and from many other people's polls. That was a moment that we now actually have to struggle to remember that we all felt we're all in this together. And so the fact that we've gotten ourselves where we have now in, you know, just a few years later, it makes it all the more poignant. Americans don't like this feeling that we're being divided, but we do. We do feel that we're divided. Now, how we got there is, as I say, the interesting question.
Listeners, are you part of a polarized America? How would you answer the survey question that Robert Putnam just posed? Do you think America is very polarized? And then how would you answer the question for yourself? Do you feel like you are part of a polarized America? And if so, is that a bad thing? Do you feel part of a pole, or do you feel caught in the middle? And what, if anything, should we do about it? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Dr. Putnam, I'll stay with you for just a minute. You said there are some other things that you want to put on the table. So Juan mentioned the tendency of the parties to get out their base, along with Senator Danforth. And Juan mentioned the impeachment of President Clinton, and I guess the willingness of the Republicans to go there, to go all the way there over Monica Lewinsky, and how that polarized the nation. What else would you put on the table as basic underlying causes?
Well, let me begin with a point that actually everybody mentioned about moving to this getting out the base strategy. That didn't used to be the strategy of American politicians. That is the strategy, as Senator Danforth said, it used to be that politicians went to the center. Now you have to ask, well, how come we're not going to the politicians who are rational people and want to win elections? How come they don't see the elections being won in the center? And the answer, I think, is that it goes back, I have to say, to the last 30 years' trends towards civic disengagement. Ordinary people being much less involved in politics and civic life, community life, bowling leagues, and so on.
Relevant to your book, Bowling Alone, where you saw the general breakdown of community in the United States, political and otherwise.
That's exactly right. But if you look at from a political angle, what's happened is that moderates have disengaged more rapidly than people at the extremes. The image I have in my mind, I don't know if it works, is a kind of a cake that's fallen. It's fallen in the middle more rapidly than it's fallen out at the edges. So it used to be that if you went to a local PTA meeting or some civic meeting, most of the people in the room would be kind of in the middle, and there'd be a couple of people at either extreme. Now, all those moderates are no longer there, and the people who are showing up and the people who are going to the polls are the people who are more at the extreme. So it didn't used to make sense to try to win an election only by mobilizing people at one extreme or the other, but when you can't get the moderates to the polls, and that's what's happened as we've disengaged from voting too, you might then figure, well, we could actually win just by getting a lot of our guys or gals to the polls and not worrying about the middle. And that's essentially why the political strategies have changed, not because somehow politicians have become malevolent, but because under this new environment in which moderates are AWOL, are not showing up to meetings or elections or whatever, the rational election strategy has changed. And Karl Rove is really important, not so much because he's an evil guy. I mean, he may be evil, but that's not why he's important. It's because he saw that more clearly than anybody else in American politics, that you could win only from your base.
Juan, what else? A polarized media, the internet, driving everybody into, you know, smaller and smaller niche echo chambers, redistricting. What else?
Well, you know, I just love this. I think Robert Putnam's really onto something, and it helps me in my thinking because I'm so much inside the political machine. But I don't always see the larger demographic or sociological angle, and I just love it that he's there. But I got to tell you, from the inside perspective then, the way that I see it is that you use wedge issues to appeal to that base. So you find a wedge issue. We may not be, as a society, for example, to cite something that Professor Putnam was talking about, abortion. If you look at the numbers, it may not be that we are so wildly disparate in our perspective, but there are people who are energized by that issue who are at the extremes. And so if you want to get money out of their pockets, if you want them to come to a meeting, you have to speak to their extreme feelings. And so the moderates don't show up, and the moderates aren't reliable, and they aren't reliable in terms of fundraising. And so you go to the extreme. So I think that's why wedge issues work. If you're traveling around the country, as I've been this political season, you'll see negative ads. Why are negative ads playing when everybody says, oh my God, these are such tawdry negative ads, I think politics is awful? It's because they work, and it's because they appeal to the very worst you know, people who are angry. I think people who are upset about this latest John Kerry statement, whether it was a mistake or not, they're people who are trying to energize a base. And so they're using it as an instrument, a political instrument, again, to get to the far, the deepest extreme in terms of that base. And that's what we're seeing. And so when Robert Putnam talks about the absence of the middle, I think he's exactly right. And when you talk about the media, you look at the cable universe, you look at the radio universe, you look at the internet, it is so segregated by political perspective. The idea of broadcast, or, you know, Walter Cronkite telling American stories to American people, that's gone. People simply want preconceived notions reaffirmed so they can bang on the dashboard and say, I'm glad somebody's telling them the way I want it told. I think that's what's going on.
But yeah. Juan, is that entirely a bad thing? I'm not sure if I'm more afraid of diverse groups of citizens passionately expressing their interests and ideas, or a bland, homogenized fuzz where real differences are tamped down in the name of unity, as may have happened in the mythical Uncle Walter Cronkite days.
No, but I think that what you're hearing, Brian, what you're hearing and described, and I think it would be a combination of what Professor Putnam's saying and what I'm saying, is that the middle is gone. I mean, they're just, you know, the whole appeal, and I think that it had something of a magnetic pull on the edges before. People had to compromise. They had to be reasonable to appeal to that middle when the middle existed. And so, you know, it's the old Lincoln saying about, you know, evil triumphs when good people don't do anything. But in this case, good people aren't there. It's not that the people at the extremes are necessarily bad people, but they are extreme. They really are not representative mm-hmm. of our politics. So when Professor Putnam asked in his poll, do you feel that there's polarization in the American electorate or the body politic? People are saying yes, because they're seeing what's going on at the extremes.
93.9 AM 820 WNYC.org. How polarized are American politics, and do we need to be that polarized? With NPR senior political analyst Juan Williams and Harvard public policy professor Robert Putnam, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When we come back, we'll start taking phone calls. We have a caller from Washington Heights who says, no, we're not really that polarized. We have a caller from Brooklyn who says he doesn't think there's anything wrong with being so polarized. And on from there, stay tuned.
You know, you have both Joe Lieberman and you have me somewhat at risk in Connecticut, and that's a fact. And the biggest challenge has been that we have been in the center of this political spectrum.
Republican Congressman Christopher Shays from Connecticut. It's our 2006 election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, and tomorrow we complete our marathon. 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 30. Is the middle class an endangered species in the United States? And if so, which party is best to preserve it? But we've also decided to add a bonus issue. That'll be on Monday. We will debate what to do about New York State Controller Alan Hevesy. But we continue now with Issue 29, How Polarized, How Necessary, with NPR senior political analyst Juan Williams and Harvard public policy professor Robert Putnam and Keith in Washington Heights. You're on WNYC. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
Oh, what a total myth. We're so polarized. Go take another poll and ask people if we're more polarized than ever before. I'm sure they'll say yes to that, too, because that's what the media is telling them to say. But, of course, in the 1800s, go check out the political situation in the 1800s, and it was about 100 times more nasty than it is now.
You're talking about a little thing called the Civil War?
Yeah, that too. We also fought a Civil War. Go speak to somebody from another country, all right? Go explain to them that we have neighborhoods throughout the United States where, you know, you have a Catholic living next to a Protestant, living next to a Muslim, living next to a Jewish person, and whites and blacks in the same block. You know, in the other countries, they have separate neighborhoods and they fight civil wars. You know, when they have elections, go check out the Mexican elections. Every time they had an election, they're all shooting each other. The candidates are getting shot. Hey, it's nothing like that. You know, I have a conservative next to a liberal. You know what he says? He says, good morning, how are you? It's so overrated. Oh, we're deeply polarized. We're nothing. It's not true.
So, Bob Putnam, in historical perspective, in global perspective, are we making a mountain out of a molehill?
Well, Keith is certainly right. There have been periods in American history that have been more polarized than this, and they led to civil war. And there have been other periods when we've been more, for my taste, too much in the muddled middle. There is a historical pendulum that's swinging back and forth. But the most serious work that's looked really systematically at these changes over time does say that we're now pretty far up the historical swing toward a more polarized America, and so compared to other, not compared to the 1850s, and probably not compared to some earlier periods in American history, but compared to the long sweep of American history, yes, we're in an unusually polarized period in American politics, and of course, we're less polarized than many other countries in the world, where there are shooting wars going on. This is not Lebanon, or this is not the former Yugoslavia. On the other hand, compared to most of Western Europe, we're actually more polarized than most of those countries, or
so
Canada,
then,
or other places around the world. So,
but then, what are the consequences of the level of polarization that we have? I mean, maybe it just feels bad to look out and go, tisk, 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 everybody's sniping at each other, but are there more serious consequences than that?
Yeah, the first-order consequence is that given the levels of polarization we're at now, Americans don't actually trust what the government's doing. Esteem for public officials and the media and so on is all down. So Americans' judgment is that the system isn't working the way they'd like it to work. And, you know, it's a democracy, so their views have got to count. Beyond that, I do think it's the case that on some tough issues, you can't get the kind of bipartisan people in the middle that for any of the major changes, major reforms in American politics, like Medicare or like solving the healthcare crisis. We cannot solve the healthcare crisis in America. It's a serious crisis. We won't be able to solve it through one party alone. And so, there's a serious consequence there. We can't solve our shared problems.
Juan Williams, consequences?
Well, I think there are lots of consequences. And you know, I mean, in response to the caller, I think it's sort of, to my mind, the immediate, if you look at the immediate contrast, it would be, you know, post-World War II. And you saw then a much broader middle, and you saw that middle much more engaged in the civic activism that Professor Putnam measures, and much more likely to go out and participate in American politics and to vote across the board. So I think that's the point of contrast for me. There's no contrast globally. Obviously, you do have these places, you know, if you consider what goes on in terms of, you know, South Africa, Lebanon, et cetera, there's no contrast. But we're talking about American democracy, and we're talking about as contrasted to a previous generation or two. And by that measure, I think it does have a strong degree of polarization. And when you talk about consequence, I see it here all the time. But, you know, just recently, when you had in New Jersey the decision by the New Jersey Supreme Court on gay marriage, you saw the response that came from Republican candidates around the country. They saw it as an opportunity to energize their base. They didn't say, you know what, here's an opportunity because we have a court in the majority ruling about principle. Here's an opportunity for us to establish some compromise and move forward. Well, to the contrary, what was seen was an opportunity to further divide and energize people.
So that's true on the couple of issues that the two of you have mentioned. But let me read to you from a David Broder column today. Actually, I got it off the web from a Georgia paper today. I don't know if it's in the Washington Post today where it originates. But he writes about a study done by the Hoover Institution and the Brookings Institution called Red and Blue Nation, Characteristics and Causes of America's Polarized Politics. And they acknowledge that polarization is real. But it says when it comes to weighing the consequences of these divisions, the authors offer some useful counters to the prevailing pessimism. In one powerful paragraph, they set forth their refutation of the notion that polarized produces gridlock. Whatever else the overall legislative record of recent years may show, sclerosis has not been a distinguishing characteristic, they write. Reform of the welfare system, substantial tax reductions, big trade agreements, a great expansion of federal intervention in local public education, important course corrections in foreign policy, reorganization of the intelligence bureaus, a significant campaign finance law, new rules governing bankruptcy and class action litigation, a huge new cabinet department, massive enlargement of Medicare, for better or worse, all these milestones and others were achieved despite polarized politics. Dr. Putnam?
Well, some of those achievements that were mentioned are significant, and some of them are more fictitious. They didn't really solve the underlying problem precisely because people couldn't come together over the issues. But I'm not claiming that the only thing that's going on in American politics today is polarization. But I do think that it's true that there are some issues that basically everybody agrees are unsustainable issues, some big issues that are unsustainable, like the budget deficit or the healthcare the problem. Those are the two that we've kicked down the road. And everybody knows that we've got to solve this Social Security problem over the long run. Everybody knows that we've got to solve the healthcare the health insurance problem. But those are not going. Those have not been solved. They won't be solved as long as people approach them from a partisan point of view. So can I make one more point? I don't want to divert you, Brian, from where you're headed. But you made an earlier point that I think is part of the causal background here that we have not yet touched on enough, and that is redistricting and gerrymandering, which has drastically reduced the number of competitive seats. That means that there are relatively few people. Chris Chase is one of them who are in seats that are swing seats. Most congressmen don't actually have to worry about going to the middle, given the way their districts have been gerrymandered.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've been districted into seats that are meant to be safe for Republicans or safe for Democrats for the most part, and so that makes everybody kind of pander to the bases in those districts. But Juan Williams, what about somebody like Christopher Shays? I mean, is moderate even the right word, or does he just have a collection of official points of view that happen to relate to the people in his district, and some of them, like on social issues, we tend to call moderate, and some of them on social, some of them on maybe fiscal issues and the war in Iraq, we tend to call conservative.
I think that's right, and also, I mean, it's the reality, the real politic is it's not even the constituents in his district; it's the people who are funding him. It's the, you know, special interest, the people who pump money into his campaigns. It's the people he responds to in the Congress. For example, when the caller was the Broder column, talking about things that have been accomplished, what struck me as I was listening was, you know, in many cases, that was a function of a large Republican majority here in Washington. You had Republicans in the White House, Republicans in the Senate controlling, and Republicans in the House controlling. So you would get a dynamic such as what Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay did, where nothing would go forward unless they had what they called a majority of the majority, meaning that most Republicans, just on Republican votes, were able to pass legislation, were able to go forward on Medicare reform, for example, despite objections that might have been coming from Democrats. So what you get is really one party moving forward on issues they select. But overall, I'm surprised at that column in this sense. One of the real sad points, I think, about the last Congress has been how little it's accomplished. People just look at it and say it's a do-nothing Congress, and I don't think that's too far off the mark.
NPR's Juan Williams, Harvard Public Policy Professor Robert Putnam, with me on WNYC as we talk about polarization in America and what, if anything, to do about it. Reggie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi.
Hi, Reggie. We have a terrible line, so get right to your point.
Yeah, I just wanted to say it seems to me that the polarization problem has to do with the fact that the center is so far to the right. Even the terms of the debate is so narrowly focused from maybe a moderate liberal stance to a far right stance that even anything approaching something further to the left is considered extremist or outside the terms of the debate.
So in that context, as you see it, then it is a good thing to be polarized because it takes you out of that destructive consensus that you see.
Absolutely. There's just so narrow terms in terms of what is considered a legitimate thing to even talk about that I think there needs to be more polarization to have a more variety in terms of people to actually have some choices and to actually start thinking about how they want the direction of the country to turn.
Juan, anything to that from your point of view?
Well, I mean, that would be an invitation to third parties, and I think it would really break apart the political structure. Now, you know, there's nothing against reinventing the game, but I think there is a lot to be said for the fact that we've had such a stable political structure here, and it has been a disincentive for people to pull away, to secede, and all the like. You know, they've even had arguments in Canada about secession, and we see what goes on down in Mexico, our neighbors, in terms of violence against people, in distant quarters. So, no, I mean... But his point about making sure there's a more varied political discussion is well taken, because I think the discussion is to right of center in American politics today. But in fact, and probably properly so, it's because of the election results. The election results we've had, except for Clinton, we've had Republican presidents since the 80s. And if you look at control of the Congress since the, Republican Revolution of 94, we've had Republicans in control on Capitol Hill.
Phil in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I reject the suggestion that both the left and the right are responsible for this polarization. I think that's kind of a variation of a Karl Rove talking point about angry liberals. I think we've seen an unprecedented attack by, like, extreme right-wingers on the legacy of the New Deal, and people see how unjust and unfair the right-wing agenda is for average Americans, and they're kind of forced to fight back. I mean, they've attacked the progressive tax system, Social Security, you know, environmental protection. It just goes on and on. It's like, you know, Rove and his cronies keep slapping us in the face and then complaining about all the face slapping that's going on.
So you're saying polarization is a tactic of one side, the right, because it benefits them. It's not that people on sort of both ends of the political spectrum are waving their sabers in the same kind of way to begin with.
Exactly. Do they expect the people they're attacking to just, you know, sit there and complacently wait while it just gets worse and worse and worse? No,
right.
We're going to stand up and fight back.
Well, a conservative would say, I've had George Will on this program sitting here saying, well, the liberals started it, you know, with all that stuff in the 60s and the 70s and all the, attacks on the family and all the attacks on traditional values and the activist courts and all of this stuff. And so it was the conservatives who felt besieged and had to fight back.
Well, then we had the 70s where that stuff kind of worked itself out in the broader culture, and we came to some kind of consensus about stuff. And, you know, these people just weren't happy with that, and they wanted to drag us back to the 1950s.
And the new left, he would say. Juan Williams, what do you make of that discussion?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I watch and I see, for example, Howard Dean have such success on the internet. And again, that was appeal to a base, and the base was fed up with Republican politics on the national level. And so they had a strong response. And I think that you see that you can go on the blogs and that's what you'll discover. I think they're now left and right wing blogs. But the left wing really drives, I think, in terms of the political activism for a long time, was driving that conversation. So, yeah, I think that's right.
Phil, thank you. Robert Putnam, do you want to weigh in on that? Because there is a sense, certainly, I can tell from just the callers to this show that whether they're from the left or the right, there is the sense that the other guy started it.
Yeah, I was trying to probably my own political views and Phil's are not that far apart, and so I can hyperventilate with the best of them about Karl Rove. But I was trying to step back a little bit and say, how do we get ourselves into this situation in general? I'm not putting equal blame on both sides, but I do think that it's not enough just to say the other guy did it first. You need to step back and say, well, how did we all get in this situation? And that doesn't mean unilateral disarmament, but it does mean things like having the thing that I think we could most easily fix in all of this is actually to undo partisan gerrymandering. That would have a huge effect. And that's fairly relatively recent that we've had such extreme gerrymandering so that most seats were safe seats. If more congressmen had in their own district to worry about differences of views, we would have a more productive debate, including a more effective raising of issues that probably Phil and I would both agree about inequality. I think it's obscene that we've got this growth of inequality in the last 20 years in America, but we can't get that issue out because it doesn't fit with the existing ways in which the constituencies have been defined.
Interestingly, Eliot Spitzer, presumably at this point the next governor of New York, has talked about taking on this safe seat redistricting at the state level in New York and trying to mix up districts a little bit more to create a more vibrant political culture. I don't know if anything like that is possible on the federal level. If one house
is controlled by states, but if it were simply done, it would be possible to take this part at least out of politics. It used to be out of politics. There are states in America now where the redistricting is not done by the legislature and therefore is not at the whim of whatever party happens to control the legislature, but is done in a more neutral way. And we could go to that. It's not rocket science to figure out how to move to a system in which you had more objective, more unbiased drawing of district lines.
What else?
Well, I wish it were so, Professor, but we're headed in the other direction. I mean, if you look at what's been going on, what happened in Texas in the early part of this decade under Tom DeLay's direction, when DeLay was in charge here in Washington in the House, is that you had more redistricting. And in fact, you not only had redistricting at the 10-year mark, when the census is taken, you've had now redistricting done in the middle of the session, and redistricting to take advantage of the dominance of one political party or another. And then the Supreme Court ruled that that was totally legitimate. So the court has affirmed that kind of action. And I might add that, you know, it's not just Republican, Democrat, left, right. It's, gosh, it's black and white and now increasingly Hispanic that these districts are gerrymandered to racially separate us. And go ahead.
No, I agree with that one. But on the other hand, it's not true that this is a political non-starter. I mean, the Republican governor of California, for example, has made this issue, trying to redistrict in a more unbiased, nonpartisan way, a core concern of his. He's not my favorite politician, but it's interesting that Schwarzenegger is actually on this issue, from my point of view, on the side of the angels.
Interesting that we may have a Schwarzenegger-Spitzer alliance on this, on two of the biggest states in America, from governors of the two different parties.
Yeah.
I'd be 100% supportive, but I'm just saying I don't see it happening because, and here's the hidden secret, Democrats and Republicans like it. Why? Because it leads them to higher rates of reelection, which
right.
are now at absurd levels.
But why
but
not
the,
just
politics is all about getting reelected.
Not just Democrats and Republicans, but you touched on the racial question, and I wonder if you see, whether it's redistricting or anything else, how to depolarize American politics without leaving minority groups of various kinds, political minorities, ethnic minorities, whatever, behind from some new centrist consensus. Because you know one of the reasons that there's redistricting by race is the Voting Rights Act. It used to be that minorities had basically no say because they were always in districts where they were in the minority. So some of this districting is to guarantee electoral power to African Americans and Latinos and others. And so how do you get back to something depolarized without re-marginalizing marginalized people?
Well, no, but here's the thing. What it was taken to an extreme. That word comes up a lot in this conversation. The idea from the courts under the Voting Rights Act was that you would not diffuse concentrations of blacks so as to prevent a minority person from gaining office. But what's gone on now is, especially in the southern states, the Republicans embrace this to a fairly well. They said, yeah, okay, so we'll put all people of color in this district, and then we'll separate them out from all the whites. And mm-hmm. what that has resulted in is you get a small number of guaranteed minority districts, but then an overwhelming number of all white districts where the politics are just to the far right. They become extreme. And I think that's a distortion of the basic tenet of the Voting Rights Act.
All right. Well, we will see how much is different if Democrats take power in Congress. We will see how much is different if Elliot Spitzer and Arnold Schwarzenegger have their way on redistricting. I want to thank NPR senior news analyst Juan Williams and Harvard public policy professor Bob Putnam for joining this discussion. Issue 29 in our 30 Issues in 30 Days series, How Polarized, How Necessary. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome, Brian.
And that is today's 30 Issues in 30 Days. Let other media wallow in the polls and the attack ads. We've got issues, and we know you do too. Tomorrow, issue 30 is the American middle class, an endangered species. And coming up in a minute, a toast, red wine, 100 glasses a day, every day, to your health. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.